Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think it sometimes doesn't pay to be connected to everything all the time. I think it's just that we believe that we think we're connected and we're not, in a way. What we do is we go round and round in circles. I think it's a rabbit hole. I've learned personally to protect myself in the evening. And I reach a time where I just shut everything down. And there's peace in it. I don't need to know what Trump said right now. It's still going to be there in the morning. And I'm disconnected from it. And there's wonder in that.
What is manliness and can open water swimming reduce stress and anxiety? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm coming to you live from the West Cork Literary Festival on beautiful Bantry Bay, where the likes of Zadie Smith, Liz Nugent, Deborah Levy, Louise O'Neill, Bernard McLafferty, Alan Jenkins, Richard Beard and the great Margaret Drabble gave a series of workshops, readings and talks in venues across the town. There was yoga on the lawn, festival swims, coffee and chat in Bantry House and lots more. On Thursday evening, Irish novelist and short story writer Joseph O'Neill took to the stage at the Maritime Hotel. I nabbed Joseph just before his reading from his new collection of short stories, Good Trouble, published by Fourth Estate.
Well, I'm Joseph O'Neill and I'm holding a copy of Good Trouble, which is my first collection of short stories. I've also written, I think, four novels and a family history called Blood Dark Track, which actually is half devoted to my Irish grandfather.
Joseph, really well done on Good Trouble. It's a very amusing piece of writing, very comical in parts, very probing on society and nature of relationships in other parts. I might ask you a little bit about the title for the collection, Good Trouble. It comes from John Lewis there a couple of years ago. He asked students in a college to find a way to get in the way. It's an interesting take, isn't it?
Yeah, John Lewis is the civil rights hero in the USA, where I live now. And if you look at all those pictures of Martin Luther King, there's always, in the corner of the photograph, you'll always see a picture of the young John Lewis, who was the leader of the student branch of the civil rights movement. And and he had this catchphrase, and still does. He's still going strong. And that is good trouble. And he was his thing was, you know, that people should look to get into good trouble, which is what he did. You know, he was getting arrested resisting the injustices of his time, a resistance which continues, of course. And so I like that phrase because some of these stories have this political, contemporary sort of political dimension to them, I suppose, and at least in my mind. And I also liked it because it's sort of because of all the connotations and the sort of, you know, good trouble, you know, people having trouble being good, people sort of enjoying being in trouble in some way.
So what's politics all about to you? And do you think it could be argued that today it's not quite the moral endeavour it possibly set out to be?
Well, I mean, I've lived in the USA now since 1998, so I've lived there longer than I've lived anywhere else, and so my sense of politics is derived from that, from watching American politics, and they have a very kind of mixed. It's a very mixed scene over there. The main problem being that the politicians are essentially funded by private interests, and so are not really public servants, and are very often using their power to sort of, you know, promote the interests of the people who fund their political life, their political careers, and at the same time, you also have this, you know, sort of radical and sort of interesting, and I suppose alarming as well, kind of liberalism. in the USA, which is so globally influential now.
Your opening story, Pardon Edward Snowden, is a very amusing piece of writing, and it kind of unpacks, I suppose, the idea of a poem as a petition. And one of the characters in the stories linked idea of Bob Dylan getting the Nobel Prize for Literature as part of the Trump phenomenon and linked the two. It made me laugh so much, and I'm just wondering, what were you trying to get at there?
Well, that story is about the main character in that story is a poet, an American poet who's asked to sign a petition to pardon Edward Snowden, and the petition is supposedly for poets to sign, only poets, and it's written in verse. And he sort of gets into this rather comic tangle about the whole business, and because the petition is such a bad poem in his opinion. And he discusses it with his friend, and he relates it, as you say, to Bob Dylan. They somehow get onto that subject, and you know, I have to say that I do think that if I'm pressed to take an issue on a stand on this issue, which I'm not, but my sympathies are with the poets, because I remember that at the time, the thing about the Dylan Nobel Prize was that he was, and this is discussed in the story, is that they were calling him a poet. They weren't calling him a songwriter, a genius songwriter, which everyone would agree with. Yeah. They were calling him a genius poet. And I think there were quite a few real poets, if I can put it that way, who weren't thrilled about that.
You have an hilarious story called The Referee, where there's a guy called Rob, I think, and he's trying to get a reference from either ex-girlfriends, old flatmates, old working colleagues. And he's desperately trying to contact everyone he knows, and most people aren't too pushed about him. And it's an extraordinary piece of writing, and I'm sure everyone can relate to it, having it either a bad flatmate or very uncomfortable circumstances with somebody that puts them in a position where they don't want to give a reference. But I was just wondering, if you were to give a reference for yourself, where would you go?
If I were to ask for a reference? Well, I mean, funny enough, I got this. That story is about, if I may answer that in a roundabout way, that story is about a guy who's just gotten divorced and lives on the West Coast, comes back to New York and needs a reference just to live somewhere. The building won't let him in without reference. And he's sort of scrappy. He doesn't really know anyone. And he's having a hard time, as you say, you know, getting anyone to just say he's an okay human being. And I feel like that sort of quest for a reference is a sort of slightly kind of comic dramatic version of that sort of reassurance we all need, you know, that we're actually okay. That, you know, we're fine. Where would I go for a reference? Yeah. I don't know. I usually would ask for, I'd sort of try and find a friend who's got a job. And so, and you can write it on, you know, on sort of official paper or something. But actually, you know, to be honest, that particular story was inspired by my own experience of getting a reference. I managed to get the references, but some of them were so bizarre. And so sort of the people, I mean, that was something I thought about writing. You know, some of them just started just writing completely irrelevant stuff about themselves, you know, you'd be amazed at how, actually maybe you wouldn't be amazed at how, you know, complicated it can be just to get somebody to say, this is just an absolutely fine person, you know, you should be lucky to have him in your building. It's such a weird situation to be asked to write a reference for somebody, you know, to summarise their good qualities.
Yeah. But also within that, does any real reference really represent the truth?
Well, no, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if someone says to you, can you vouch for me as a human being, so, you know, for the purposes of living in the building? I mean, it's just such a weird request, yeah. Really.
I think my favourite story in the whole collection is The Poltroon Husband. And it made me laugh so much. And it's basically a husband and wife are in they have, I suppose, best described as their now retirement house.
Yeah.
And they're surrounded by forests and it's all very idyllic. And the wife hears some unusual sounds in the night. And the husband has what is described as a mental whiteout. And you give a whole range of different kind of psychological states, which is really quite remarkable on why he had was, I suppose, failure to act. And that can be quite catastrophic in relationships. And it got me thinking that, you know, what makes for a good marriage? And, you know, there's obviously love is involved, friendship is involved and all of those wonderful things. But possibly when it comes down to it, it's all about solidarity.
Yeah. I mean, this story, actually, the idea for this story came from a Henry James idea, which Henry James was had kept a notebook of stories, ideas, and he never wrote half of them. He never got around to finishing. So I was asked to look at these ideas for an anthology, and I chose this one. And the idea being, you know, the husband who's so cowardly, I suppose, that he doesn't investigate the noises, and then it's the wife who must go down and investigate the noises. And Henry James thought you couldn't write this story from the point of view of the husband because it was just so appalling. This sort of, what he called this, he used the word poltroon, this kind of poltroonism, that readers wouldn't tolerate being in the presence of such a point of view. But I wrote it from his point of view. And they have a happy marriage, as you say, and they seem to have solved the question of marriage. In fact, the whole business is, the whole story is, they seem to have solved it all. They've still got they're in semi-retirement. They've got this perfect house, and then there's this noise in the night, and she's the wife is the one who must investigate, and it's sort of funny, but it does put their marriage under this, you know, rather old-fashioned, I suppose, kind of pressure, you know, because, I mean, it's not often that the vestigial courage that, I mean, men don't need to be courageous anymore, you know, I mean, when, you know, the so-called, like, you know, we hardly ever go to fight in wars like it would used to be common, and that sort of idea of masculine, you know, the man looking after the woman in a situation of danger, you know, it doesn't really arise very much, but suddenly now it does, and this kind of couple discovers they learn something about each other.
But it's a very interesting space for the reader, because you ask yourself in your own life, what would you do? And also in terms of what you're willing to put up with, and how our protagonist wriggles out of his responsibilities and how he kind of sells it to himself. And then he sits within his unease within the relationship. And there's an unspoken unease. Yeah. It's a very interesting space, but I suppose all of us in our relationships, we've been in that, we've asked ourselves that question of solidarity. And I suppose in these times when we talk about gender parity and equality and everything, but ultimately part of love is about courage and protection and solidarity.
It is, but it's also about acceptance.
True.
And I feel like the sort of challenge for the wife in this case is to accept the fact that her husband has failed this test of kind of doing what, you know, his masculine role would lead people to expect him to do.
There's a great feeling of unease, frustration, and general uncomfortability running through all the stories. And, you know, you're tackling questions of identity, you're looking at questions in relation to masculinity, relationships, intimacy, fatherhood. But within that, percolated all through the stories, is this frustration and this anxiety. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like one thing a male writer can write about, just as women writers are now sort of, as it were, being slightly more proactive about claiming certain viewpoints, claiming certain standpoints, claiming the right to say certain things. You know, one thing men can write about is the flip side of that. You know, it's this idea of which has such political resonance now, particularly with the rise of this hyper aggressive kind of right, sort of neo fascist sort of, you know, masculinist, extra ultra hyper masculinist kind of, you know, political sort of movement across the world, is this question of what is the status of masculinity. Now, speaking for myself, I grew up in a family where the women were very, very strong, and I was never under any sort of particular pressure, as I recall, to sort of, you know, to prove myself as a man. This whole idea of being a man wouldn't have been in the language, you know, that my family would have used particularly, but I guess the culture would have communicated that particular expectation to me, And I do feel that it's a sort of very interesting and very sort of funny sort of area of you know, of movement in society now, where the, where men are no longer, you know, they're no longer sort of, it's that sort of joke, like, what are they actually for? I mean, there used to be this absolute sort of value in men, a problematic value, obviously, but an absolute value, which is that they were physically stronger, and that, that physical strength was very, very essential, you know, in the history of human beings, to sort of, but that's gone now, for certainly for the bourgeoisie, for the middle classes, and it's sort of left this, and then, and meanwhile, there's been this kind of emancipation for women. Yeah.
Surplus to requirement, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a sort of, there is definitely. Well, I don't think men are completely surplus to requirements. I mean, they're still sort of vaguely sort of needed, yeah. But definitely the sort of standing and the sort of cultural capital that men have has changed dramatically, and it's sort of it's funny, really.
Where did you get the idea for the death of Billy Joel?
That's a story which concerns four guys. Who go off to Florida. One of them is having is celebrating his 40th birthday, and they decide to mark it by playing golf together. And oh, that's right. I'm just trying to remember the story actually. And then, of course, and then at a certain point, they come. The and our sort of hero, the guy whose birthday it is, mishears something on the radio, and he thinks that the death, or sees something on the TV, that's right. He thinks that Billy Joel has died, and then the whole weekend is spent with the guys chatting, you know, on the footing that Billy Joel is now dead, but in fact he isn't dead, he's just got remarried. And it's this sort of idea, that I don't know what the idea is there, just a funny idea. Meanwhile, the men themselves are trying, they're turning 40, they're having their midlife moment or their midlife decade, and they're sort of trying to come to terms with mortality and change and marriage as well. And you know.
And they're all proving points and getting very touchy about cash, and there's this tremendous unease.
I got this sort of pettiness about cash. Yeah. They're always like, "Who's you know, you paid for the valet parking? I will set that off against the toll." They're always scrambling. But I got that from my experience of having college friends in England.
Right.
To this day, if I hang out with these with my friends, they'll be sort of mentally totting up. In a way that is kind of funny and sort of alarming.
Very off-putting, though, isn't it? But I suppose that's what happens.
Well, it does to these characters, and it does. I mean, I do feel like sort of if you have friends from an early age when you were all broke together, and part of the banter was all about, you know, whose round is it and this, that, and the other, then it might be that that persists. But funny enough, I was walking yesterday actually in New York City before I flew over. And I saw a big poster for Billy Joel, who's sold out Madison Square Gardens over 100 times, which is some sort of world record. And so the Piano Man is still going strong.
So will you be sending him a copy of the book?
I don't know. Nobody wants to read about their death.
Tell me, how did you decide within these stories to keep them as a short story? Because there's at least three or four that are very novelistic. So I'm just wondering, how did you decide to commit to an idea to see it through the short story, which takes a lot of craft and a lot of hard work, and I'm sure isn't miracled over a few hours, that you could be chipping away at a couple of weeks at some of these stories. But I'm just wondering, how do you decide to commit to that?
Well, I asked myself the question, how do I ever decide to commit to writing a novel? I mean, the short story is such a sort of powerful, it's a form which is more and more sort of interest to me. It does. You can do so much in a story, and you can write it. You know, it doesn't take a 5-year bet, or in my case, which is what it usually takes me to write a novel, 5 or 6 years, if I can answer your question this way, you know, why write a novel? That's the sort of question that that occurs to me. Obviously, there are good reasons to write novels, but
for example.
Well, I mean, they can do things that short stories can't do. But I'm so interested in the kind of contained power of the short story. I mean, they feel more like poems. They sort of, a novel is something you can sort of read and pass the time with. But the short stories, particularly, hopefully these, sort of force the reader into a sort of interpretive moment. It's like, what just happened? What is that story about?
Yeah, it forces the reader into there's such punch to short stories that you automatically reflect because you've grasped the idea and you're left with the idea.
Yeah, and it's also manageable. I mean, you know, some of these stories are a little bit enigmatic, and I like that. I like the idea of the sort of drawing the reader into a kind of into that sort of collaboration with the text.
One of the stories called Goose is where a guy is going to Italy, and his friend is getting married for the second time, and it's a rather elaborate wedding. And he goes into an internet cafe, and he clicks on something, and he sees there's a story about a skeleton has been discovered. And he pitches out a question, and the question is something on the lines of that there's these body skeletons are found in an embrace of sorts. Yeah. And he asks himself, could he live with somebody, or could he be in this embrace with somebody for 5,000 years? Who could you embrace? Yeah. It's a very interesting thought experiment, isn't it?
Well, I actually saw that, and that's how some of these stories, I'll see something interesting like skeletons found locked in an embrace, they've been there for 5,000 years. And the article then, like in a classic clickbait way, would say, who would you like to be in buried with for 5,000 years? And, so I used that, my own experience of encountering this strange story. And he says to himself, well, I guess that would be my wife, and I guess it's going to start happening quite soon. So the whole romance of the sort of romantic kind of excitement about these skeletons, when on further reflection, maybe a little sort of predictable, really. Yeah.
So lastly, what is the hope with this collection? Because they're a very interesting range of stories probing at different aspects of political life, gender, identity, a whole lot of different things, race relations and so on. So I'm just wondering, what's the hope and what you want the reader to reflect upon?
You know, you write these stories one at a time, and I don't think you... this collection exists actually essentially because I reached a certain number of stories that were capable of being collected in one book. And I'm only now starting to sort of, as it were, approach these stories as a reader of this book would, which is as a collection. And I don't know what my hope is. My hope is that people enjoy it and also sort of appreciate this is, I think, asking a lot, but appreciate the sort of the craft of it and with the various decisions that are made to produce these little moments in the story.
That was Irish novelist and short story writer Joseph O'Neill. Good Trouble is published by Fourth Estate and retails for just under €16 in hardback. Wednesday morning, British journalist, ghostwriter and memoirist Alexandra Hemmingsley gave a hugely entertaining talk at Bantry House on her inspiring book Leap In, A Woman, Some Waves and the Will to Swim. I joined Alex for a quick dip at Abbey Strand on Bantry Bay.
Hi, my name is Alexandra Hemmingsley and I'm here in Bantry Bay for the swim. I am author of Running Like a Girl, which came out in 2013, which was my memoir about being a terrible runner and doing it anyway. And my latest book is Leap In, which is about how I conquered my fear of the water and swimming and learnt to love and depend on, to some degree, swimming in the sea and outdoor.
Alex, really well done on your talk today in Bantry House. And there were so many interesting questions from the audience. It was a really interesting dynamic. When I say the word swimming or getting in for a swim, what does that all mean to you?
I suppose I think of swimming outdoor when you just say the word swimming, because that's what I do, doesn't mean it's the only valid way to do it. Yeah, getting in for a swim, I think of sort of engaging with nature and an opportunity to clear my head rather than just simply doing my half an hour of exercise for today.
You said something very interesting in the talk. You said swimming is all about adaptability. And it's also about trust.
Yes. I mean, less so if you are someone who just loves that hour in the morning to go and do your laps in the pool. But swimming outdoor is definitely about adaptability. What it taught me was that just going at it, oh, it worked last time and I'm trying really hard, so why isn't it working now? It's not a valid, it's not a practical way to swim. In the sea, you need to work out what the tides are doing, how the water's moving, how you're feeling, what the weather's been like the day before. And that's kind of how life is. You can't just turn up for a meeting and give the same answers that you gave last week because it worked last week. You need to be able to assess and adapt and have the confidence in yourself to maybe surrender a little bit and be a bit different or try something else.
Can we talk about Leap In? Is it fair to describe the book as a memoir of sorts?
Yeah, absolutely. Like Running Like a Girl, my other book, which was about running, it's sort of 75% memoir. And then there's a bit at the back with the sort of, I didn't want to tell everyone, oh, I did this and I did that, and then not give them somewhere to head off next. So there's sort of everything you want to know about kit or basics of what front crawl is and a little potted history and things like that. So
you give some very good recommendations as to reads, and there's some very good other swimming books in the book.
Yeah, swimming has wonderful literature, significantly better than running, I think. There's a real heritage of beautiful swimming books, and there's been a sort of crop of swimming memoirs the last year or so, which has been lovely. When Running Like a Girl came out, no one else was doing anything like it. And then I've spent the last 18 months doing events and talks and festivals with a group of really wonderful people. There's Jenny Landreth's book, Swell, Jo Minahane's book, Floating, Jessica Lee's book, Turning. They're all really beautiful memoirs about water and swimming.
Why do you think so many people have a huge fear about swimming in the open water? What is it? Now, I know today we're here down in Bantry and there's been lots of jellyfish as we were swimming, so a few people were worried they would get stung. But why do you think there is that real fear out there?
Well, it's totally reasonable. It's an absolutely basic survival mechanism to feel anxious about putting your face into water, which renders you unable to breathe. And also, unless you're in the clearest of water, you can't see what you're coming up against. And so you're effectively stopping yourself from breathing, which is a primary function of survival, and from knowing where you're going, which is also an essential sort of health and safety requirement. So I feel like too many people feel like they're somehow bad or lesser for being afraid of the water, but you should. It's not necessarily just fear, it's respect. You are not going to be able to beat the ocean. It's learning the adaptability and the respect and the practical tips for your well-being. It's not a matter of getting rid of the fear.
You went for swimming lessons, and it was at the start of the book, and your coach said to you, just relax. And it sounds so simple and so basic, but it can be a very scary thing to manage your breath and water.
There's absolutely nothing less relaxing than being told just relax. It's what happens at the beginning of the book with the swimming lessons, and it's what happens towards the end of the book when I start doing IVF. You're told with swimming and with IVF, if you can just relax, it will work. It will be so much easier, which is the worst thing to be told, because you're then putting pressure on the act of relaxation. At least if you just relax because you're feeling relaxed, you're truly relaxing. If you're relaxing because you think it's the key to achieving something, it's by definition not relaxing. So it's, yeah, you have to untangle that and learn it might not be relaxing at first. It might be a couple of months of feeling really scared and nervous before your swimming lesson, just the same as you might be scared of needles or treatment or whatever with IVF. You have to embrace the fact that something's scary, because to a degree, things that are scary are often the things that are most worth doing, because you're living life, you're at your fullest.
Do you think it has liberated you in some way to be able to conquer a fear of the open water and then to swim so calmly?
Yeah, it's been completely liberating, because it's not just taught me about swimming and water, which is felt like having an extra door opened to me and my whole new room in my house, as it were, but also it's taught me that I have that adaptability with other fears, that other challenges can be met, because I was so scared of the swimming in the water, and to have worked a way around that knows that not just that I can swim, but that I can work a way around a problem, which has been a gift.
Some people will be very concerned about some of the safety factors related to open water swimming. So can you talk me through some tips that you may have?
Well, you should have safety factors. Learning to not be terrified of swimming doesn't mean disregarding safety. You shouldn't get in cold water if you're not used to it. You should acclimatise over months, and even then probably not just jump straight in. And you should know what the tide is doing, and you should know whether you're swimming in an area where there are jellyfish, and you should check these things. But that's just the same as you should, you know, educate yourself with a view to getting a job or check the road before you cross it. It doesn't mean don't do it. Just because you need to make some basic precautions before doing something because there's a potential danger doesn't mean that the thing in itself is undoable.
Presumably you're wearing a wetsuit though sometimes, are you? Certainly in wintertime.
No, I don't. I used to, but now I don't. I acclimatised. I swam 3 summers now without a wetsuit. And one of those I was pregnant for, which I was significantly warmer for, a bit more insulated.
You said something very interesting. You said that, you know, when people are trying to acclimatise their bodies to cold water, and especially around Ireland where the sea can be very cold in winter, you said that you have to go in gradually. Mm. And this, you know, I suppose it gives your core an indicator to absorb the water, so to speak, that it isn't such a body shock.
Yes. When you get in the water, in cold water, the blood vessels will constrict to move blood to your core body to keep your vital organs warm, to keep you alive, and that in turn will make your hands and feet much colder quicker. That's why you get your extremities feel cold first, because the blood's been actively moved away, and that's it makes you feel cold, but you should in a way feel proud, because that is your body working perfectly to keep you alive. What you shouldn't do is jump in unacclimatized, because that constriction will put enormous pressure on your heart in an instant. So you need to get in slowly, breathing out, exhaling slowly to keep your heart rate as low and steady as possible while that constriction and change happens. And then it is much more doable. I mean, you have to be careful about how long you spend in the water, because it's basic physics that the water will cool you down faster than you will warm the water up, because the water is a lot bigger than you.
You swam a full 5 kilometres over to Ithaca, wasn't it? As part of the writing of the book, it was one of the journeys that the book takes. And I know that you said earlier that you're a big fan of Homer's The Odyssey, and you always wanted to be the adventurer like Odysseus. Can you talk me through that?
Yeah, I read it. I read classics at university, and I was always obsessed by Odysseus as a sort of late teenager and in my early 20s. And then time passed, and I'd read more and read around it. And then I sort of started to think, well, Penelope was just at home. I want to be Odysseus. I want to be my own hero, not sit at home and wait for a hero. And my dad was in the forces, and so we moved around always in my childhood. I didn't come from one place. So the idea of home was always very intoxicating to me. And Ithaca kind of really is one of the ultimate representations of home, that longing, that 10 years of trying to get back. And so I really wanted to do the swim, and it helps that, you know, the Greek islands are beautiful and Ithaca is heavenly. So yeah, I really, really wanted to do it, and it was the hardest swim on the week's trip that I took. And yeah, it was a real moment for me, a real something I'll cherish forever.
You write very movingly about the going through the IVF process, and you were swimming through, and you know, you talk about the space that you had in the water, and you talk about I suppose the freedom away from all the pressures. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was a huge sense of solace to have swimming, because I'd become very proud of my body when I'd run 5 marathons, and I was strong and I was relatively slim, and I was you know, it was a hard won fight to like my body. And then when I was doing the IVF and I had a miscarriage and I was so sad and really fell out of love with my body and, you know, not how it looked, but what it could achieve. And then suddenly it sort of felt like it sort of turned against me a bit. And to keep swimming and to keep having that relationship with my body, giving me pleasure in the water, and the fact that the water really supports you, and it's the sport that you can do if you're sick or injured or elderly or frail in whatever way, was a huge gift to me.
There's a whole body of research about swimming and anxiety and how swimming helps with calming the mind and, I suppose, putting you in a state of calm. Have you found that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's sort of enforced mindfulness. You can't be fretting about the gas bill or your status in society if you're not a mother or whatever, if you're having to focus on the simple act of exhaling enough before the next wave hits you in the face. Yeah. It really brings it to an elemental matter of survival, and that keeps you in the present in a way that sort of meditation and mindfulness tries to train you to do, and swimming sort of inflicts it on you.
And it's relatively, you know, stuff free in terms of all the gadgets.
Yes.
You know, you have your goggles, you may or may not have a wetsuit, but it is, pardon the pun, stripped down.
Yes, it is. And you know, you could swim, I mean, you could swim with absolutely nothing at all, and lots of people would argue that that's the best way to swim. So yeah, that's it is the most elemental. You are in nature rather than on it or moving along it, you're moving through it.
So what's the hope with the book?
I just the main thing that I get in my inbox from people is, I thought it was just me. And it was, for years, it was about running, about I thought that I couldn't do this and I can. And I would love for people to feel that about swimming, to know that these fears, which they might think are irrational or embarrassing, are not, and lots of people go through them, but there are ways around them.
Here I am, floating in emerald sea. Keep me dancing, keep me as still as can be. And I try to keep the balance right. And I try, but it feels like wasted.
British journalist, broadcaster and ghostwriter Alexandra Hemmingsley. Leap In, A Woman, Some Waves and the Will to Swim is published by Windmill and retails for just under €10 in paperback.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm coming to you from the West Cork Literary Festival in beautiful breezy Bantry, where the best in Irish and international writing talent gave a series of workshops, readings and talks around Bantry Town. Next up, it's British writer, journalist and editor Alan Jenkins. On Tuesday morning, Alan led a nature walk around the hills of Bantry Bay in advance of his lively coffee and chat at Bantry House. I caught up with Alan just after his festival talk.
I'm Alan Jenkins. We just had a talk in Bantry House. We did a walk up to the stone and a lot of people came. I was quite amazed, really.
And it's a lovely morning here in Bantry House, Alan, and great to see the crowd about. Tell me, when I say the word morning or morning time, what does that mean to you?
It means light. It means time. It's just, I don't think anyone feels they have time anymore. And it's that there's a timelessness about the morning. If you no longer chase the day, if you just get up and are ready for it.
So what prompted the book? I know that you are a big gardener and you spend a lot of time in the early mornings at your allotment. But presumably meeting lots of other people and early risers motivated the writing of the book, did it?
No, I think it was the other way around. Right. I think what it was is that I get up early and then I was looking for other people who did. It's for me, it's a time... I have a quite a demanding day job. I work for a newspaper. I'm an editor at the Guardian Group. And it's that I need time to do the things that I want to do. And it's that, so say if I want to go to the garden, then if I go there at that time, everything's quiet, everything's alert, and foxes will come, and green woodpeckers will come, and kestrels will come, and I can do all the things that I need to do to sort of feed myself rather than just like to eat. And I still have the whole day in front of me.
So would it be fair to say that getting up early is a form of nourishment for you, something like that?
I think it's nourishment. I think it's also a kind of medicine, but mainly it just gives me the gift of time. I think it's that at the moment, no one knows what... We used to know when to go to bed because the BBC would tell us or our mum and dad would tell us. And then we thought, oh, we're teenagers, we don't need to be told anymore. And now there's no reason to go to bed because you've got Netflix, or you've got another reason to always stay up. And I think, like, I interviewed Jamie Oliver, and he says on his phone, he has this thing that says, go to bed now. And it's that we value night more than we value morning. I think morning's always had a bit of a bad press. It's because it was sort of seen as female adulthood and kind of, you know, like creativity was night. It was men drinking whiskey and writing long books deep into the night. And there's something special about being awake when everything's quiet and everything is alert and everything else is just also beginning to wake.
As you mentioned Jamie Oliver there, you've interviewed a lot of different types in the book,
yes.
Writers, thinkers, cooks, all different types of people. Yes. You mentioned Jamie Oliver there, and I think he's big, he's fond of his bath in the morning. But he said something very interesting to you. He said that, you know, that we should think about, you know, our kind of morning patterns, our sleeping patterns and all of the rest, that it is as essential as a good, healthy diet.
I think he says food is nourishment.
Yeah.
And I think it is. I think it's just the, you know, time is nourishment. Sort of, and being away. The thing is that with him, for instance, that he's Jamie Oliver. So from 7:30, he is Jamie Oliver in inverted commas. And so if he wants to just be himself, it has to be in the morning, because every other minute is taken up of him. And I think it's like, I talked to also on the walk today was Philip Hoare, a writer. He goes to bed between 7 and 8 in the evening, wakes up at 3, goes then cycles down to the sea, swims in the sea, and then comes back and writes. And his day's finished by 7 o'clock in the morning, when most people haven't even started.
It's interesting the way some people would see that some early risers are very successful people. Others people see it as a form of eccentricity. Why do you think that is?
Because it's because you're standing outside of the norm. I think it's just anything that stands out. And I think it's also the thing is, to some extent, that to do with success, it was like, you know, it was like, say, Margaret Thatcher, you knew, only slept 5 hours, or bankers and businessmen, they started 5. This isn't that. This is a book in place of choice and in praise of choice, I think. And it's just to also just a sort of quiet time to just do that. We don't. People think they don't have time, and truthfully, they do. They just choose to ignore it.
So do you think we possibly should look at time a bit differently, maybe?
I think so. I think the thing is, it's that no one has a reason to go to bed, and so that they don't have a reason to get up. So everybody gets up pretty much time to when they have to leave the house. So they know they have to leave the house, say, at 9, and think, oh, I need an hour and a half to have a shower. And it means that you start the day always chasing. You're in a rush. You have to get out the house. You have to move. And what I'm saying is that there's this thing. There's almost like a little wardrobe in your house, which allows you to step through it. And the half an hour that you don't have to rush is timeless. It's worth like 4 hours.
Can we talk about your approach to the book?
Yeah.
You met with scientists, philosophers,
priests,
all sorts of different types of people. And they all had an individual kink, if you will, to getting up early.
Yes, but what I did was I talked to creative people I knew, poets and painters, fishermen, and that I knew that light was important. But also what I wanted to do was I wanted to look at the science of it. I wanted to look at the neuroscience of it. I wanted to look at philosophy. And I talked to priests, and I went and stayed in a monastery where there's silence at night. And because it seems to me that if you want to understand something like science, religion and philosophy are pretty much the ways that we define the stuff that we don't understand. And so There is now cognitive science that says that if you live in the east of a country, you're more likely to wake up early than if you live in the west of a country. And that's to do with the way the sun moves. And it's to do with, there's a whole kind of batch of information that we know about the fact that the body operates to a 24-hour clock that we weren't particularly aware of. And the science now tells us that we're more creatures of light than we used to think. 20th century meant that we didn't have to follow time anymore. We had computers in our pockets. We knew everything there was. And it's beginning to understand that we're more natural in a way than we had any gave ourselves credit for. There's one of the things that the philosopher does is that he ran two pieces of tape. One was cold water running and one was hot water running. And he said, which is which? And it was obvious which was which. And it's because, and you think, well, how can that be? It's just a tap. Why? But you know that hot water sounds differently. It's that we know a bunch of stuff that we don't any longer think we know.
One of the ladies I was very interested in reading about was an artist called Jane. Yeah. And she talked to you a little bit about how she carves out her own individuality, yes, in the early morning, and it's a key part of her identity, and how it's almost a consistent in development, if you will, that she's constantly using the morning to develop that space for herself, yes, for her own understanding of the world. And that allows her to cope with a lot of different challenges that she's faced in her, yes, life.
Well, I think it's also the thing is, it's classic that she's a mother of, I think, five children. So it's one of, it's how do you do all the things that you have to do for everyone else and be there for everyone else and still have something if you want to be creative? She's a painter. She's actually a really gifted painter. And so you have to steal that time. And the only time that you can't steal it. You can't say to your kids, oh, I'm not going to make your dinner tonight because I have to go off and paint. So what you do is you create the time that you have. And in the day that you have to, that's the time that's there.
What's the early morning like in Denmark? I know you spent a lot of time there and your wife's from Denmark.
My wife's from Denmark. It depends. In the summer, the Danes have it's almost pure light in Denmark. So that in the summer, they go from having about only 2 hours of dusk. Yeah. And it's really only dusk. It's never really dark. And it's that, and I wander around there in the middle of the night on my own. My wife is an owl, which means that she sleeps longer. It's more difficult for her. I dragged her up yesterday morning at 3:45 to take her to the James Turrell to lie on a stone at 4 o'clock to watch the dawn coming up. And I thought, so she didn't come to the talk this morning. She values her sleep. So Denmark gives me quiet, but it gives you a different light. This is going to sound, I don't mean to sound too painting, but it's a sort of opalescent light. There's a blueness. Which you sometimes get in Cornwall. It's the sea. And it's that thing where you're looking and it's just all grey or it's all dark. And then you suddenly see that it's divided. And you see that the sea is, you know it's the sea because it's darker. And there's a line that appears, almost like a watercolour painting. And you realise that it's, the difference between the sky and the sea is one's a reflection of the other and one's colder. And you can tell by looking at it that it's colder.
Do you think that type of light can change the way you think? I know that's a bit of a mad question, but in terms of, you know, when you get large parts of the summer where there's very, very little darkness, and do you think that kind of changes your mood a bit?
Oh, well, one of the things I do is I go to the, for the book, I went to, on the summer solstice, you know, the highest point of the day, to the Arctic Circle, where there is no night. And it was the thing, can morning exist without night? And the truth is, it does. But it's that what happens is that the sun is up, the sun never sets. You watch it and it just sort of dips and rises. But everything, there's a point at which you suddenly feel it on your arms and you're suddenly aware that everything's a little more alert and you're not quite sure what's happened. The light hasn't changed, but the feeling of the air has changed. And you're aware that it's morning. It's a sort of magical thing, I think.
Some people could possibly find that very distracting, though, couldn't they?
I think what I like about it, they talk about winter and maintenance. There's this wonderful idea because they go from having like 2 hours of light. I've been there in January where it's the sun rises at 11:20 and sets at 2:10. Magical. And the sun hardly rises, and it's quite so that everything that they have to do at that time, and it's almost like bipolar. So at 4 o'clock they're out painting their houses. At 4 o'clock they're out mowing grass. They're out sowing seed, because they have this. It's precious to them.
Yeah, it's a window of opportunity.
Yeah, it's the only. Yeah. When you don't have much choice, the choice that you have becomes powerful and becomes kind of more energized because you have to do it then. Because the winters there are fierce, and you know, the wooden houses mostly, because there's no one's going to ship concrete up at that height, and they work at that time. And I wasn't very good at it. I mean, I found that 24-hour daylight, I found it, I operate on very little sleep, but I find it hard to sleep more than an hour or two at a time.
I loved what the philosopher Barry Smith said to you. He said that, you know, getting up in the morning is borrowed time. It's a very interesting way of looking at it, isn't it?
Well, it's because it's time that you're not supposed to have. So therefore, it becomes that it's kind of precious and you value it in a kind of different way. It's that we don't value the morning. We value night because we value music and creativity. And we thought that's what being grown up was, to like sort of drink whiskey like Hemingway, play jazz like Coltrane. It was that's what creativity was. And people who paint, there are many more paintings of sunsets than there are of sunrises. Yet if you look at a painting of a sunrise and you're not sure if it's a sunrise or a sunset, the light in, he looked, there was a painting that he chose, and there's a light that's inherent in if it's sunrise, in that it's cooler, there's more promise to it. Yeah. It's more special.
Do you think we need to be a little bit more grateful for the morning? I know some people can get up with a terrible sense of dread, and others are more optimistic. But maybe if we come at it like that, it possibly could give us more purpose to our day.
I have difficulty telling people how they should feel, I think. But what I think is, for me at least, it's full of alertness and opportunity and a time that has a specialness. But I'm also aware that for some people, sleep, there's a sort of fascism of sleep, which is that sleep, you need 8 hours sleep. You don't have 8 hours sleep. So if somebody wakes at 4 o'clock, they don't know what to do. They lie there for 2 hours full of fear that they're going to get up. Yet if they actually just slipped out of bed and read or did something or went for a walk, they'd have a more wonderful day. It's that time is, it's special.
Alan, I'm just wondering, do you think it's fair to say that, you know, social media or technology use and just kind of chipping away at your phone during the late hours is causing a lot of people problems when it comes to their bedtime sleeping?
I think it sometimes doesn't pay to be connected to everything all the time. I think it's just that we believe that we think we're connected and we're not, in a way. What we do is we go round and round in circles. I think it's a rabbit hole. I think the thing I've learned personally to protect myself in the evening, and I reach a time where I just shut everything down, and there's peace in it. I don't need to know what Trump said right now. It's still going to be there in the morning. Yeah. And I'm disconnected from it, and there's wonder in that.
But that takes a lot of discipline.
There's no discipline in saying no. It's literally just, I don't need that. There's a wonderful release in it, freedom in it.
Yeah. But a lot of people will bring their mobile phone to bed, or they'll have the radio on during the night, yeah, because it takes away from the loneliness of the night.
But also people, if you sit and you're eating in a restaurant and you're eating with them and you go to the loo, you come back and the person's on the phone. It's just that we're addicted, I think. And I'm not sure addictions are necessarily to be celebrated at all the times. I think we don't yet understand the power of having a computer in our pockets.
Well, how would you encourage somebody to get up a little earlier and possibly develop a routine around it? How should they begin?
Truthfully, the only thing to do is go to sleep earlier. It's really that. Is it because you don't have to watch the Newsnight program? You don't have to download another 8 episodes of Netflix. What you do is you simply, at around 10 o'clock, you think, I'm tired now. Or even just go to sleep when you're tired. People don't, because it used to be you'd stop because everything went quiet. You went to bed because nothing happened. Or your parents told you, or the BBC told you, or they played the national anthem, or whatever the hell it was. And you had to do it. Now we don't have a reason to go to sleep. And then we're tired in the morning, so change it. The one thing I would say is, just sometimes go to sleep when you're tired. It's a good thing. Jamie Oliver tells the truth.
That was British journalist, writer and editor Alan Jenkins. Morning, How to Make Time a Manifesto is published by Fourth Estate and retails for just under €11 in hardback. Now, I have to say, this is a gorgeous piece of writing. It's reflective, expansive and incredibly relaxing to read. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big shout out to all the staff at the West Cork Literary Festival, including Festival Director Emer O'Herlihy, for putting on such an eclectic mix of talks, workshops and public interviews. and to the supremely organised Jean Kearney of Kearney Media Communications in Cork City for all her help coordinating my festival interviews. We've been talking books. I'd like to close tonight's programme with the uplifting words of Alan Jenkins from his new book, Morning, How to Make Time a Manifesto, where Alan concludes, give yourself the gift of time. Join the human larks and the blackbirds. Start with a morning a month. Work up to once or twice a week. But try to keep it special if you can. Encouraging words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.